Good afternoon. Just to then briefly recap what we looked at this morning. So this morning we spoke again about how the afflicted minds arise. So like last night, this morning we mentioned the sequence that the perceived object is perceived by a sense power, and then from that begins the whole conceptual conscious performance, where there are a number of minds present, including the arisal of attachment. And then we also spoke about how our attachment arises through touch. And that was in the second verse that we looked at this morning. And then we spoke then not only about how the arisal of the afflictions, but we also spoke about various techniques for the abandonment of the afflictions. So how we should incorporate this then in our daily practice is that we need to reflect every day about the faults of the afflicted minds, so that we come to see their faults very clearly and generate the strong wish not to come under their control, knowing that they only bring harm to ourselves and to others in this and future lives. And then accompanying this should come the wish to engage solely in virtue, to only be of benefit to others. So this morning we're talking about various techniques, or this morning and last night, we're talking about various techniques to overcome or suppress the afflictions when they have arisen. In other words, how to free our mind from the influence of the afflictions, but only on a temporary basis. So whilst such techniques are beneficial to us in the short term and our suffering then and there, it doesn't. We know from our own experience that the afflictions continue to arise one after the other after the other. And that is because we haven't managed to eliminate their root cause, or cut the root of the afflictions. That is what we haven't managed to do. And as long as the root stays intact, then afflictions will continue to arise. So now we come to look at how to deal with the root cause of the afflictions, and how to cut or sever this root of the afflictions. And this now brings us to the 27th verse. In order that you see the absolute, get used to truly understanding things. No other practice is there such as this, possessed of special virtues such as these. So in order to be able to eliminate the arisal of any and all of the afflictive mind, so whether attachment, aversion, or any afflictive mind, one needs to come to know, to see the what we have here as the absolute. So the absolute is one translation. The one we're more used to here is to use the term the ultimate. So one needs to come to understand the ultimate, and then in this way, one can sever the root of all the afflictions. So this then can also be expressed in other ways, not only the ultimate, because the meaning of ultimate here is emptiness. And then again, this is a term we're more familiar with, but it can also be called truth. And generally in the world, when we talk about someone or a situation, we'll say that we'll use the term truth or honest. So it has that connotation as well. So whether we're talking about ultimate or emptiness or truth, then it has the same meaning here. Then generally in our Buddhist context we talk about emptiness. And if you've attended teachings for a period of time, you would have heard a lot of discussion about emptiness. But those who have yet to come to hear about the presentation on emptiness, then for them to hear this term is going to create some confusion, or maybe there would be some obstacles. So therefore, an alternative term which is easier to relate to would be used, such as ultimate truth or truth itself. So I'll start then with using the language that is generally used in the world, such as truth and false, or ultimate. Or ultimate, or maybe we could say in accordance with reality. So I'll start using that terminology and later talk about emptiness.
Yeah,
Generally, in the world, before anyone embarks on something or engages in something, they will go through a process of analysis. So they'll think about, so what am I looking to achieve? What is the best technique that I can engage in so as to achieve this? And if I was to do this, what outcome would come? And what outcome is likely to come, both in the short term as well as in the long term? Would this be beneficial or harmful? And how would it relate in terms of benefit and harm to myself and to others? So this way of thinking is used in almost all our activities. We first investigate, and we investigate according to these criteria, looking at the impact on ourselves and others, looking at whether this impact is beneficial or harmful, or we could say gain, there's gain or benefit, or harm or loss. And then we think both in the short term and the long term. And then if we see that this method that we, or this idea that we've got, or this thing we want to do, is seeming like it's unmistaken, then we could call this true or ultimate. And if we see that actually this technique is faulty, if there's a mistake within it, then we could call it false. So this is something that we generally do in the world, and it's what we also do in our context of the Buddha Dharma. So that's what's meant here in these first two lines. But I'll just change one word here when I read it. In order that you see the absolute, get used to correctly understanding things. So truly is not mistaken to say truly, but for us it has other connotations. So correctly understanding things. So what is meant by this term, correctly understanding things, is that one should examine with a way of thinking that is correct, or a way of thinking that is unmistaken or is true. So this is what is meant by this term, correctly understanding things. So before we engage in an activity, whether it's a new business venture or something that we're going to buy, then we'll investigate, and we'll try and investigate with this correct way of thinking. So investigate in an unmistaken manner. And then if we embark on an activity or purchase something, and we go about it in a false way, a mistaken way, then this will involve such things as lying or cheating, stealing, etc. However, if our technique or our method is one that is honest or truthful, then this will not involve such activities, and then this could be called honest or true or ultimate. Then the first type of activity, that which is mistaken, that which is false, then this leads to the arisal and acting under the influence of the afflicted minds. And then this leads to problems for ourselves, problems to others, in terms of arguments, disagreements, people knowing that they're being cheated, and this leads to disharmony and problems. Whereas if one is engaging in, we use the term ultimate or honest or true behavior, then this is unmistaken, and this will follow then from an analysis to a correct way of thinking. And here the outcome will be mutually beneficial, harmony will increase, etc. If we look at the third and fourth line then, no other practice is there such as this, possessed of special virtues such as these. So what that means is that if even in the world, if someone engages in activities with an honest motivation or an honest approach, and these activities are beneficial for themselves as well as for the community as a whole, then everyone in the world appreciates such a person and appreciates such activities and develops a good relationship with such a person and trust within them. So everyone would praise these activities and this behavior and such a person. And they would see that there's no one better than that in the world, or no behavior, a way of thinking that is better than that in the world. Whereas on the other hand, someone even who's wealthy or has influence and power, if such a person is dishonest and has accrued their wealth and power and influence in ways that bring harm to others, then whilst people will recognize that this person has influence and power and wealth, no one will want to associate with that person, certainly not to have a hard connection with them and consider them a friend. So in the world, so such people who engage in this, the false behavior, they are not trusted. They, people do not want to associate closely with them. We've now used the more normal terminology, or ordinary terminology rather, such as true and honest and ultimate. So let's now turn this to our Buddhist context using the terminology we usually use. That would be emptiness. So here our subject matter is how to completely eradicate all these afflictive minds, how to completely abandon them. And as we've heard, what we need to do is eliminate the seed from which all these afflictions arise. So how does this relate to emptiness? Well, emptiness, or the mind of the ultimate, this comes about due to, first of all, engaging in analytical investigation. So just like we were speaking about a moment before, when we were talking about investigating an activity before we engage in it, or a purchase before we make it, and here we're talking about engaging with a proper understanding. So here we engage in the investigation in terms of how phenomena exist. So we investigate the way that any object exists. So that's the starting point, investigating how something actually exists. Then the mind that comes to realize how something exists is the mind that is realizing, or the wisdom that is realizing emptiness. And this is the meditation that we need to engage in so as to sever the root of all these afflicted minds. Starts with maybe taking as attachment as an illustration, but the process is the same throughout, because the seed or the root is the same. So we've spoken about the faults of the mind of attachment a lot, and therefore the need to abandon it. So we've also spoken about how the mind of attachment arises, and arises in dependence on an object. So the object is encountered, and there is an appearance to the mind. So the appearance to the conceptual consciousness, not to the eye sense power, appearance to the conceptual consciousness of the object. And how does that object appear to the mind? So this is what we need to investigate. So in brief, let's use the terminology straight away, it appears as being truly existent. So what does this what does it mean if something appears to be truly existent? It means that it appears to be independent. It appears as if it's not dependent on anything else at all. So it appears as if it's not dependent on parts, it's not dependent on causes and conditions. It appears independent. It appears unchanging. So these two, independent and unchanging, these are the two factors of how something that appears as truly existent appears. So this term true existence is what we'll use here, but in many similes, such as ultimately existent, etc. There are many like this, but we'll just stay with true existence. So this is the first thing we need to come to see. How does this object of attachment appear to the mind? Then secondly, we have this appearance, but it's just an appearance. Then we have a mind that grasps at this appearance. And this mind is called the mind of true grasping. It's grasping at this appearance of true existence. And it's grasping at it as if the object exists in the way that it appears. So this mind is called the mind of true grasping, and is grasping at the appearance of true existence, believing that the object exists in the way that it appears. Now this mind of true grasping, this is the root of all our afflicted minds. So in this example, we've spoken about an object of attachment. But this mind of true grasping is the root of all afflictions, not just attachment, the root of all our afflictions. So as there's only one root to all the afflictions, when this mind is eliminated, all the afflictions are eliminated. So just to recap briefly. So first of all, how does the object appear to the mind, to the object of attachment? How does it appear? And that is, it appears to be independent. It appears to be unchanging. And then what mind apprehends it? This is the mind of true grasping. And that is the root cause of all our afflictions. And therefore, this is what needs to be abandoned. So if this mind then of true grasping is the root cause of all our afflictions, then clearly this is what needs to be abandoned. This is what needs to be completely eliminated. So how to do that is through a process of investigation. So meditating with an analytical mind, an investigating mind, a mind that, as you have here, truly understand things. In other words, a mind that thinks properly, thinks in accordance with reality, investigates in an unmistaken manner. So here the investigation is looking at this mind of true grasping and how it functions.
Ah, 마티바 나는 뭐 이거 내가 좀 통은 어디 이 여가 지금 지금으로지 너저히 봐하고 그러고 이제 건 이거 좀
되네 되디 duck ducks in 대충으로 저기 돼 그냥 대충 된다 오케이 되네 거서 되네 거서 So how do we engage in this investigation? So we start by first by looking at our thought process. So we've been looking for now for several sessions at our thought process, and we've spoken about how these afflictions arise. But there's within this there's the role of the self or the person or the I. And so if we're looking now at our minds, we will see that when attachment comes, there is something with a mind within us saying, I want this, I like this, I want this. So if there's an object that we attach to, we want it, we like it. Or if there's a mind to say of anger, then there's the mind that says, I don't want this, I want this away from me. So there's this I, and this I is then underlying the arisal of these afflictive minds. So this I, or this person, or this self, this is what we should start out by investigating. So the process of investigation is similar to what we just heard before. First, to try and see how this I appears. And so we heard there that if we look and we can see how this I appears, it should appear as being truly existent. And we heard a moment ago what that means, so the truly existent I appears as if it's independent and it's unchanging. Then the second step is then to investigate the I. So the first step was to see how it appears, and then to investigate this appearance. So the I appears in a certain way, does it exist in this way? And so now, if the I appears to exist independently, it should be able to be found. So it appears to be independent, it appears as if it's not dependent, if it's unchanging, so therefore it should be able to be found. So where is that I? So it's going to, it should be somewhere within our aggregates, so our physical aggregates or our mental aggregates. So we investigate, and just to say briefly, we go through our various body parts, and no matter where we look in our body, we're not going to find a body part that is ourselves, that is our I. So then, if it's not in the body, it must be in the mind. So we look at our various minds, and again, one needs to look in detail, but just to say it briefly, we have a lot of minds, we don't only have one. So is our I the mind of anger? Well, we hope not. So is the I then maybe the mind of love? Well, of course it's not, because what happens when love isn't present? Then there's no I? Of course not. So we investigate, and we need to investigate in great detail. This will then bring us to the conclusion that the I cannot be found anywhere. We've looked within the physical aggregates, we've looked within the mental aggregates, and we've looked in a lot more detail than has just been said now, but we can't find anything. So this not finding anything is an understanding of mere emptiness. So this is the first conclusion that one comes to after first seeing how the I appears, and then investigating to see if that appearance is in accordance with how it exists or in accordance with reality. And then we come to an understanding that it doesn't exist in that way, and therefore we come to an understanding of mere emptiness. So now this mind, this understanding of emptiness, this is realized by a mind called the wisdom realizing emptiness. So this mind, this wisdom realizing emptiness, is a mind that we need to strengthen our familiarity with. We need to, in other words, engage in this meditation repeatedly, coming to this conclusion of emptiness, because that is when we have a mind understanding emptiness. And this mind we need to cultivate familiarity with. And we cultivate familiarity with any mind by repeatedly generating it. So coming to this conclusion then of first mere emptiness through being understood by a wisdom that is understanding emptiness, this understanding then weakens the self-grasping mind. And the self-grasping mind, this is a mind that grasps at the self as existing truly, as existing in the way that it appears. So now we're coming to understand that the I doesn't exist in the way that it appears. So therefore, the mind that is grasping at this mind as existing in this way that it appears, clearly is wrong. Clearly is wrong. So coming to this conclusion repeatedly, of course, weakens this mind. So we've come in our meditation now, we've come to the point where we see that the eye does not exist in the way that it appears. We started out seeing how the eye appears as being truly existent. We then investigate, does it exist in this way? And through not finding this truly existent eye within our physical body or within our minds, then we see it doesn't exist in the way that it appears. And this is then the wisdom understanding emptiness. So now we come to an understanding that the way the eye appears is not how it exists. There is a big mistake there. However, and here now is a big however, this doesn't mean that just because we couldn't find this eye that appears to be truly existent, that there is no eye at all, that the eye doesn't exist in any way or shape or form. So how do we say then the eye does exist? So we say the eye is a mere imputation. We say that the eye is merely imputated by mind upon the basis of the aggregates. So I'll say that again. We come to the understanding that the eye is merely imputed by mind on the basis of the aggregates. So our person or our body that engages in our person that engages in many activities, for this to engage in many activities, all our various parts need to come together. So we have the mental components and all the various physical components, and they all need to be acting in unison to be able to, and acting unmistakably, able to engage in the variety of activities that we do without any problem or fault coming. And if we do have some inner difficulty, then we encounter obstacles and difficulties and problems. So now, this is a large collection of a variety of minds, and then the body with all its parts, all together, the mind with all its various parts and the body with all its parts. And all of these coming together is what engages in the various activities that we as individuals engage in. So then on the basis of this collection, we then impute self, we impute the I. So this is the basis upon which the I is merely imputed. And now this, but to the mind, the I appears to be truly existent. And then our mind grasps at this. So this is the appearance of true existence, is the mind that grasps at it is the mind of true grasping. Or in the case of the self, we call that same mind the mind of self-grasping. The stronger this is, then the stronger the resulting afflictions. Whereas the stronger the understanding that rather we, what we're calling the I or the person, the self, is imputed upon this collection of physical and mental aggregates. The stronger that mind is, then the weaker its opposite mind, the contrary mind, the self-grasping mind is. So we've started out by saying how the root of all our afflictions is this mind of true grasping. And so from this one mind, all these afflictions come. And we can call this mind self-grasping if the object happens to be the self. So therefore, there's only one root cause, one root to abandon. And no matter, so the object can change, but one is always trying to get back to eliminating the same root cause. So we've spoken about the meditation in terms of if the object is the I, the self, the person, and we're looking within ourselves in terms of whether we exist in the way that we appear. So that same technique can be applied to any other object. So let's take an example when we're angry with someone. So someone has done something or said something to us. And so now our mind is dominated by anger. So we can use this same meditation technique here. So we think, we sit quietly in our rooms, and we think how our enemy appears to us. So this person who spoke to us in a particular way or did something. So clearly what comes to mind is we don't like them. So they are our enemy. Then that person, they themselves were angry at that time, and they were maybe thoughtless, or they were acting under some other kind of afflicted mind and spoke to us in this way or did a particular thing. We now have become angry and we've seen them as an angry person. And when we look at how they arise to our mind, we see them as being truly existent person, and their affliction which was present in their mind at the time as being truly existent as well. So we see this person before us, when we think about them, we would see them also as truly existent, and that mind that we believe was leading to their behavior, say anger, we would believe that that mind too would appear to us as truly existent. In other words, something unchanging, something independent. So now, the way that these objects, like all objects, appear as being truly existent, the same as the self, the same as any other, our own self, any object. So now we come to investigate this, and we investigate in exactly the same way as before. We take this object that appears to us as truly existent, so our enemy, they as a person appears as truly existent, or even their afflictive mind, and now we investigate to see if it exists in the way that it appears. In reality, does this truly existent person before us exist? And if it does, the person does exist in the way that they appear, we should find them. So now we embark in the same analytical investigation, and if the object here is this person, then we investigate in the same way. We look in their various body parts. Is there this body part that is this truly existent, all-full person? And we, of course, don't find it in any body part, whether it's the skin or an arm or any other internal organs, etc. So then, so we think about their mind. So this person before us, we may see them as, are they a horrible person? They're an awful person. So it's clear we've got this truly existent awful person in our imagination. But if we try and find this truly existent awful person, again we cannot find this. Because if they existed in that way, and it was on one of their minds, we should find that mind. But they're not always angry. They're not always awful. So we only need to think for a brief moment, and we realize, but actually, they cannot exist in the way that they appear. They appear to us as being truly existent. But when I look for them, I cannot find them. I can't find them in their physical aggregates. I can't find them in their mental aggregates. So I can't find this person anywhere. So this then is the same first conclusion we came to when investigating the self. And so this then is an understanding of mere emptiness. And then just like before, we guard ourselves from coming to the faulty conclusion that this person that we've investigated and haven't been able to find, and therefore we have an understanding of mere emptiness, meaning that the way the person appears is not how they exist. We now guard our mind from going in the wrong direction and saying, therefore they do not exist. So that is again, it's going too far. Rather we know through that same investigation that this person is not independent. This person is rather dependent. So what is this person dependent on? Well, again, as per our investigation, on all these various parts within the body, or this whole collection of a variety of minds, all of these come together are the various parts or causes and conditions that the person is dependent on, as well as being dependent on a third thing, and that is mere imputation by mind. So the person is imputed by mind on this collection of parts. So this is then the understanding of how the person would conventionally exist. So this is the correct understanding of emptiness. And the more we become familiar with this, in other words, the more we meditate on this, and the more maybe ingrained this understanding comes to us, then its contrary mind, the opposite mind, will start to weaken. And that is the mind of true grasping, the mind that grasps at objects as existing in the way that they appear. And that is because this mind of emptiness comes to understand that objects do not exist in the way they appear. They exist in one way, but when we investigate, they cannot be found. So in this way, this mind of true grasping, the root of all our afflictions, weakens. So here it's good to repeat an illustration that we always say in classes on this subject, because this illustration of the that this illustration serves to show how this wisdom understanding emptiness serves to eliminate the afflictions, even in ordinary people such as ourselves. So the illustration is that when class is over and we all leave here, we're walking outside, we maybe remember that at lunchtime someone is talking about that it's not getting warm and the snakes are out, so be aware. And we're walking to our car and we see something coiled up under a tree, in the shade under a tree. And immediately we have a reaction, immediately fear arises in us, because we know that the snakes are dangerous. So we have fear arising in us, and we have the thought, shall I kill it? Can I run away? Should I freeze? What should I do? And so now the hair on the back of our necks is on the end, and we are quite afraid. Then we back away slowly, we call our brave friend for some help, and they come over, and they point at the snake and say, "You're mistaken, look again." And you realize it's not a coiled snake, it's just a rope. And what happens? Immediately, through seeing that the object doesn't exist in the way that it appeared, all those resulting afflictive minds disappear. So when we first saw this coiled rope, but we believed it to be a snake and exist as a snake, then that's not this mind of true grasping. And from this mind of grasping at this coiled rope as existing in the way that it appears as a snake, all the afflictions came, such as anger, the mind of harmful intent, and the mind of fear. Then, when the wisdom of our friend intervened, then the way that this object appears, then we came to understand that the way that the object appears is not how it exists in reality. And immediately, the anger's gone, the fear's gone, the wish to harm is gone. So that shows how, through the familiarity with the wisdom understanding emptiness, that this mind of true grasping will weaken, and thereby the resulting afflictions will weaken. When we imagine ourselves in that position, we know how we'd feel afterwards. On one hand, for sure there'd be some relief, but we'd also be really embarrassed. We called our friend over and we were exposed as being a little foolish. So this is actually exactly how we currently are with all these objects that we get desirous for, all these things that annoy us and frustrate us and we get angry about, all these people that we don't like, or these people that we like too much, or these objects that we desire so and dominate our minds, all of them are based on these same misunderstandings, these same wrong minds, these same mistakes. So here we find ourselves getting all angry about an illusion. We find ourselves being overcome by desire, really wanting something that doesn't exist. So in this way, when we come to understand how things exist in reality, all these tremendous exaggerations and the resulting minds of I have to have this, if I don't have this, my life is missing something. Or conversely, I need to push this person or the situation away from me because it's intolerable. All of these will disappear because we see the exaggeration, we see the illusion. So this, we've heard now that when engaging in this meditation, investigating how objects appear to us, and then seeing whether they exist in this way in reality, leads us to the understanding of emptiness, leads us to the understanding that the way that all phenomena appear to us is mistaken. They appear as truly existent when they don't exist in this way. And this leads us to the understanding of emptiness, which leads to weakening our mind of true grasping, and thereby the arisal of our afflictions. And this helps us to go through the world in closer accordance with reality, and thereby to be less bothered and disturbed by the various disturbing emotions. So then, when we encounter, if we gain some familiarity with this this meditation and some deeper experience, then when we encounter difficult situations, such as, for example, when someone is angry with us or abusive towards us or talks to us in a way that right now upsets us or sets us off, then if we have this familiarity with the understanding of emptiness and the understanding of reality, then when we are faced by someone who is angry or abusive, we will immediately have an understanding of what they're going through and why they are going through it. So we'll have an understanding based on our own experience, and our own experience of how our own minds work. We will understand that this person right now is overcome by the mind of anger. And this mind of anger has arisen within them because of true grasping. So there's something that they do not want, probably related to us, and they're trying to push this away. And therefore this mind of anger, this strong mind of dislike, is dominating them. So this then leads us to see that they are currently controlled by their emotions. They have no freedom. They didn't choose to be like this. They rather are angry like this in an uncontrolled way. So this then leads us to deepen our understanding of dependent arising, because we see this relationship of dependency playing out in the continuum of others. And not only then does this deepen our understanding of emptiness, but it helps protect us from our minds from the arisal of the afflictions, because we don't strongly see this person now as a truly angry person or a truly awful person, but rather that what they are experiencing is a dependent arising. It's come about in dependence on a variety of causes. So this helps keep us calmer. And moreover, because our mind now has more mental space and we are not being dominated by their afflictions, we have an understanding of what they are going through, and that their lack of freedom and their suffering, compassion will naturally arise within us for them. So this is how our understanding of emptiness leads to the arisal of compassion. And now we can relate to this person with minds of love, with minds of compassion, understanding that they are suffering, that they are acting against their own best wishes, against what they actually want. And now we are able, therefore, to relate to them in a loving way, in a gentle way, in a way free of attachment, because our attitude is in accordance with reality. It's free from exaggeration.
Then
So if we stay with the same illustration where we are now before an angry person, and this angry person is directing their rage at us, if through our repeated meditation on emptiness, we are now able to stay calm, and this calmness that we are experiencing will come about due to our own understanding of our own mind, and therefore understanding the mind of the person before us. So our mind is now calm, and we are practicing patience. So this is how the meditation on emptiness is the ideal basis for the practice of patience. So the mind of patience is a mind that stays calm in the face of adversity. So here, with our understanding of emptiness, we understand why this person is angry, and therefore we no longer are taking it personally. And therefore it's much easier to practice patience. And in conjunction with this practice of patience, the space that this practice of patience gives us enables the arisal of compassion for the suffering sentient being before us. So this way of thinking, we can relate to all difficult situations. So if we think of either things we see on the news, or if someone were to steal something from us. So generally, if we have something stolen, we upset, we've lost something, and we have a negative view of the thief, and we'll criticize the thief thinking they're a bad person. But again, if we engage in the meditation in exactly the same way as for all the others, seeing how does this person arise to us as truly existent, and then we investigate and look for this appearance of true existence, etc. We go through the whole process. We will see that they rather were acting without freedom. They were acting due to attachment. And so therefore, they're engaging in this harmful behavior, this stealing activity, was due to being dependent on many other causes, such as attachment. And therefore, they had no freedom. They've accumulated causes that will lead to further suffering in the future. And this then, that having this mental space, the understanding reality, enables us to give rise to compassion for this person who has harmed us. And furthermore, we then, due to having this mental space, would be able to practice generosity by mentally saying, well, this is something that you clearly desire, and you desire very strongly, so then I want you to be happy. You can take this. Well, you've taken it, you can now keep it, and I consider it yours. And in this way, we can mentally practice generosity. This person may be unknown to us, they may be a stranger, but we can mentally practice giving to them. So in this way, through engaging in the meditation on emptiness, this meditation on emptiness serves to strengthen and empower our various other practices, such as patience, such as generosity, such as love, such as compassion.
Yeah, what you're on it, you need to go away.
So let's recap some of these benefits here, because recap the benefits so we see very clearly why Nagarjuna is encouraging directly the king, indirectly ourselves, to engage in this meditation on emptiness. So if we develop a sustained practice where we take our knowledge of emptiness and we incorporate this in our practice, and we do so repeatedly over a period of time, our understanding of emptiness will deepen. And this means our understanding of dependence arising deepens. And so this then has a number of beneficial results. So for example, it weakens the very root cause or the seed of all our afflictive minds. So as we start out, of course, the afflictions will continue to ripen. But if we continue over a sustained period of time with this meditation, then the afflictions will weaken. And not only will they weaken, but they'll start to arise less frequently. So they'll be less frequent and less powerful. And then, as we've heard now in the segment just before, not only do these destructive emotions weaken within us, but the contrary minds, the virtuous minds, these will strengthen. So the meditations that we also do on love and patience and compassion and generosity and all the other meditations, they will be powered as our they'll be powered by our deepening understanding of emptiness. So then, to summarize this in brief, our afflicted minds will weaken, our virtuous minds will strengthen, and becoming this person now, more dominated by positive virtuous minds and less influenced by these destructive emotions of the afflictions, it's clear that we'll be much happier and we'll be of far greater benefit to others as well. In the last two lines here, no other practice is there such as this, possessed of special virtues such as these. So here we've heard now quite a lot about the meditation on emptiness and the benefits that come from this. So here Nagarjuna is encouraging us to engage in this meditation because there is no superior technique than the meditation on emptiness. And then this is to be understood in two ways. So sitting here as Buddhists, we have the aspiration to develop spiritually and eventually attain the final spiritual goal, that of becoming a Buddha ourselves, attaining full and complete enlightenment ourselves. So to do that, one needs a number of good qualities. And so these good qualities we can maybe divide into two streams. And the first is the stream of wisdom. So the stream of wisdom is required for the abandonment of all the afflictions, because as we've heard, it's only through this wisdom realizing emptiness that we can completely eliminate the affliction at their root. And there is no other technique comparable for eliminating the afflictions at the root other than emptiness. Or to put it another way, it's only the wisdom realizing emptiness that can eliminate the afflictions at their root. There are many effective techniques for weakening and suppressing the afflictions, or temporarily weakening the afflictions, but the wisdom realizing emptiness will also weaken the afflictions, and it will be able to cut and sever the root of the afflictions and prevent them from arising again. So therefore, the wisdom realizing emptiness is essential for someone striving for Buddhahood. So to become a Buddha, one needs the wisdom realizing emptiness, because one needs to engage in the stream of wisdom practices. But the second stream then is the stream of method practices. So these are practices such as cultivation of love and compassion leading to bodhicitta, and the variety of other practices of bodhisattva. So as we've just been hearing, these two are greatly powered by the understanding of emptiness. And this is because through understanding emptiness well, we come to understand dependence arising well. Through understanding dependence arising well, then minds such as love, compassion, patience, these will all arise naturally and powerfully within us. So therefore, also for this stream towards Buddhahood of the method side practices, wisdom is also required. So with wisdom being required for both the method and wisdom side or paths towards Buddhahood, it's clear why wisdom is said to be, or the wisdom realizing emptiness is said to be the supreme technique, that there's no method better than the wisdom realizing emptiness for the attainment of Buddhahood. And therefore, all Buddhas have practiced in this very way. Engaging in these various practices that we've heard about, then the benefits really for oneself and others are innumerable. So all of us sitting here, we've accumulated a lot of negative karma in this life, and certainly when you look back to beginningless time, we've accumulated a tremendous amount. There's no technique more powerful for the purification of all of this previously accumulated non-virtue than the wisdom realizing emptiness. And then similarly, we all have the seeds of the virtuous mind, such as love and compassion. And so through meditating on minds such as love and compassion directly, these seeds strengthen and grow. But if we are also meditating on emptiness, on wisdom, we're developing our wisdom, then as we've heard, this will power the meditation on love and compassion as well. And then this will bring about great benefit to us in this life, as well as others in this life. And due to the tremendously powerful good karma that is accumulated through cultivating minds such as love and compassion and patience, it will lead to good rebirths in our future lives. it will ensure that we continue to meet the Dharma, to have faith and confidence in the Dharma, have the strong wish to engage in the cultivation of the minds of the Buddha Dharma. So in this way then, through engaging in these meditations on such as on wisdom and love and compassion, we can ensure that this life goes well and our future lives go even better. And most importantly, all the various spiritual goals that we have, such as the achievement of calm abiding or to enter the bodhisattva paths and to realize emptiness directly, attain Buddhahood itself, all of these approach and come much, much nearer. So therefore there is no technique better than this, there is no quality better than this. So at this point, maybe we are a little surprised by what we've been hearing in the text, because of course we don't know Nagarjuna, we don't know the king for whom this text was written. We may think, well, Nagarjuna is treating him like a parent treats a child, giving him all this advice, and this king must be a very afflicted person, totally dominated by minds such as anger and attachment and the like. So it's possible we could have such thoughts. So actually, this king was quite a developed practitioner. He wasn't a beginner. Nevertheless, Nagarjuna wrote this text that would not only meet the king's needs, but would also meet the needs of those who are not as developed as the king. And this is because a letter that is given to a king has quite a name attached to it. It will be seen as something of great importance. And the king thereby could share this advice with his subjects, certainly the entourage in the palace, but beyond that, throughout the kingdom. Whereas if Nagarjuna had written the letter specifically for the king's needs only, then that wouldn't have been much benefit to those who aren't as developed as the king. Or alternatively, if Nagarjuna had written this letter for just a peasant in the kingdom, then that letter is probably not, wouldn't have been as widely disseminated, if at all. So this is the reason why the letter was written in this style, and we shouldn't read too much into the qualities or the lack thereof of the king. This afternoon, as for the last little while, we've been looking at the afflicted minds and how they arise and what the faults are of the afflicted minds. And so for this weekend, we've looked at in some detail at the arisal of the afflicted minds, and we spoke previously about the sense power coming into contact with the object, and then the various conceptual minds arising, and we spoke about minds such as exaggeration and the inappropriate mental attention or improper mental attention. So this is something that we've already looked at, and these are important topics and to be thought about and reflected on again and again. And so how we should use then what we've looked at this afternoon in conjunction with what we looked at earlier is that we've heard that every object that appears to our mind as being truly existent. So every object will refer to, as we've heard today, the self. It will refer to physical objects. So we spoke then about the enemy outside. And it also refers to other physical objects like these. But it also refers to our various minds. So a mind will appear to our mind as being truly existent. So every object that appears, whether material or immaterial, appears to be truly existent. And all of these are investigated in exactly the same way. It's not that one investigates an object such as this in one way, or the self in a way, or a person in another way, or a mind in a different way. This process of investigation is exactly the same. One can change the object depending on the need, but the process of investigation is the same. And that, in brief, is trying to see how it appears. And this is difficult, but the result to try and come to is to understand that to understand the appearance of true existence, which has the two characteristics of it being unchanging, and that it is independent, not dependent on anything else. It is truly exists in the way that it appears. And then we investigate in a variety of different ways to see if we can find this appearance. We come to the conclusion that it doesn't exist in this way, and therefore it doesn't exist in the way that it appears. Rather, independence on this accumulation of parts, there is a mere imputation by mind. So this, in very brief, is this investigation on emptiness that can and should be done on all objects, all types of objects. Then we also heard today how this meditation, if done, this meditation will power all our other meditations as well. And in particular, if we are engaging in a variety of meditations, such as on emptiness a little bit, on love a little bit, on compassion a little bit, these, and on patience a little bit, these all help each other. They're all intertwined. The meditations are a bit separate, but the power of the virtuous minds all help each other. And they serve to weaken the afflicted minds, and as well as serving to strengthen the collection of positive minds or virtuous minds. So this is how we can engage in practicing all of these minds, the minds of the method side and wisdom side, together. And then just briefly, to take as a starting point for everything we've been hearing about, my hope is that you'll all think a lot about the faults of the afflictions and make their commitments repeatedly, again and again, not to come under the influence of the afflictions. Because that is the starting point to engage in the abandonment of the afflictions, to see them as only harmful and not to justify them.
All right.
So the next time we'll continue with looking at wisdom, but we'll be looking at it also in the context of ethical conduct. So these are two very important minds to cultivate. We've heard about wisdom tonight, but we're going to see its relationship or its interplay with the mind of ethical conduct next time. So we'll end here now, and if anyone has any questions, then please feel free to ask. So we start at the back, and then we'll come to the front.
I wonder if the Geshe could comment on the idea that emptiness can also be translated as fullness.
As what, sorry?
Fullness.
Formness.
Fullness.
Fullness. So emptiness can be translated as fullness.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So again, I'm going to say something like this.
I have it wrong, but...
Okay. Sure. I'll check. Then the also the... 研究제주 되는 아주 강화 강화라고 그래. 아니 이걸로 치우나. 아야 아니. 근데 그래 아주 이 옆에 되게 공필라서 이제 이제 편행에 포패디 톰페레 야만의 강도. 근데 톰페 研究제주 되는 아주 강화라고 그래. 강세나 이제 뭐
강화라고 다지도아
So when one engages in an investigation to see how something exists in reality, does the way that it appears, is that how something exists in reality? Then we come to an understanding that there's nothing at all that exists in the way that it appears. So this is emptiness. So to use a term like fullness, then it would imply that something is found, and there's nothing that is found to exist truly, or exist inherently, or exist in the way that it appears. So I'm not sure about this term fullness. This isn't something we'd usually say.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Brian.
Can you use do you need karma abiding to realize emptiness?
Mm-hmm.
And the second question, can you meditate on emptiness as a karma abiding subject?
Okay, so do you need karma abiding to realize emptiness? And can you meditate on karma abiding using emptiness as a subject?
Okay.
Then, sorry, the second question is that whilst developing karma abidings, so before it's developed, meditating on emptiness, or once you develop karma abiding, meditating on emptiness?
Yes, exactly.
No, that's two. The first one. So it's going to use emptiness as an object in order to develop karma abiding. Okay, good. Then the Kati Nipa, So in answer then to your first question, one doesn't need karma abiding in order to realize emptiness. But one can have calm abiding to realize emptiness. Yeah? There are many different levels to the realization of emptiness. Then in terms of your second question, again, you don't need to have emptiness as an object to realize calm abiding, but you can have emptiness as an object to realize calm abiding. Many objects that can be had as an object to realize calm abiding. Okay?
Just often after teaching such as on emptiness and the the Dharma wisdom, my mind often feels really uncomfortable and kind of afflicted and that sort of really horrible mind comes up. It's not it doesn't put me off coming back. I come back and I know there's great benefit and I can make so much sense. Is it a normal process to experience that? And what is this? I mean, I can sort of understand that there's dirt coming out from the mind, but just is it a normal process that our there's often peace comes afterwards, but that there is this kind of really
That's a good question. So receiving teachings on this topic of emptiness, leads to this reaction within your mind that of being uncomfortable and happy, this unwanted reaction, this is a negative reaction. So is this unpleasant? So is this normal? Okay, good. Then Dene nesem takpa di kibo yogiyare, kibo yomgi, kibo mepar yomgiyare, depo mindu lasan, depo mindu. Dene di namgi nangsin rebe, kase mi yankil yonggare ne di haakil chong di pento kiyare ne haakil chong, dene pelse di chik kari chongda chegiyare, shokpa che chongda chegiyasare. Yine kisimcho tongi jojo di chik re, shenpa mare, di chik shudu, yine yin sem kibo yonggi yon mare. Namgi nang se nebe? Nyokpa yina?
Yirwa. Da, gabri dini ki sem dini ki ungo re, sem gyona la chaya de ungo re, karsene tongi ko samta dini, ko tiendi ki samta dini ki yongda siwa yon mare.
So this is nothing to be overly concerned about. So for some people this will be a response when hearing teachings on emptiness and dependent arising, and for others it won't be. So just like that. Nothing to be concerned about. Okay. Just a sec, Brian. Peter?
I think this is simple. Often we've heard the term mere emptiness and also just the term emptiness. Is it the same thing or is there a distinction between?
So is the difference between mere emptiness and emptiness?
Yeah. Or is it just an added description?
Dene genla samsang kenang dong chang sunggiyare, samsang dong peni sunggiyare. Kya pa duye?
Kya pa duye? Dong sang di ming dong yin hai gobo.
Same. Yeah, but nice and easy. Brian?
What's the difference between the compassion of an arhat and a bodhisattva?
The difference between the compassion of an arhat and the compassion of a bodhisattva. Then a jatumpagi ninja. So the difference comes down to the presence of self-grasping. So there are different kinds of foe destroyers, and of course bodhisattvas at different levels. But to put it in brief, the difference will be due to the presence or absence of self-grasping. So a bodhisattva will be abandoning self-grasping and will abandon completely self-grasping. A foe destroyer will still have self-grasping. So they too will have compassion, undoubtedly they will have compassion, but they still have the self-grasping, and that the bodhisattva overcomes.
How do you get rid of self-grasping?
Ranchinsin Kandis Apangyedebe. So, self-cherishing, the opposite of the self-cherishing mind is the other cherishing mind. So this is a mind that is thinking solely about the welfare of others. So when you're under the influence of the other cherishing mind, you're engaging in an activity solely for the benefit of others. You're not thinking about what you'll get out of it. There's no self-interest involved with this. So developing this other cherishing mind repeatedly over a sustained period, then one overcomes the self-cherishing mind. And as part of this training, you need to come to see the faults of the self-cherishing and think about these again and again, the faults of the selfish mind or the self-cherishing mind, and then the benefits of the other cherishing. And understanding the faults and the benefits, this will power your interest to overcome the self-cherishing and develop the other cherishing mind. Okay, so we'll stop here then for today, and then more next time. Thank you.